Well, I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for the evening, who is Kathy Kelly. I know many of you are familiar with her work, and many of you know her for various campaigns that she's been a part of over the years, whether it was peace teams to Yugoslavia during the Balkan Wars, whether it was peace teams to Iraq during the Iraq War, whether it was visits of solidarity to Gaza, or whether it was most recently visits to Pakistan and Afghanistan to look at the impact of this war. So from all those different perspectives, I think the one thread, aside from Kathy Kelly the person, is that she always brings a passion and a perspective that I think challenges many of us within the peace movement to look at our actions, to look at the way that we've become involved with these issues, and most importantly, to challenge us through her stories to see for us, to ask ourselves if we're doing enough. We are going to have enough time for questions, and we want to have questions. So Kathy will speak for 35 or 40 minutes, and then we'll have an opportunity for you to ask her questions or make comments. I also want to draw everyone's attention to a lot of the resources that we have at the back of the room. We have the book by Phyllis Bennis and David Wildman on how to end the U.S. war in Afghanistan. It's a great primer, something, if you haven't seen it yet, you should buy it. It's a great book, only $10. We also have a number of recent articles that Kathy wrote while she was in Afghanistan, and I'm hoping that many of the co-sponsors for this evening's event have also dropped off things on the table so that you can learn more about some of the other groups that were involved with bringing people into this room. I want to read through the list. It was co-sponsored by the Brandywine Peace Community, the Granny's Peace Brigade, the House of Grace Catholic Worker, the Delaware Valley Veterans for America, Philadelphia Prawn, and Philly Against the War, and others I think I've left out. But please take a look at people's material back there. I thank you all for helping us publicize this. And with no further ado, please welcome Kathy Kelly.
Well, good evening to all of you. Just a quick sound check. Can I be heard okay in the back?
Oh, yeah.
All right, and I hope I won't blast you out in the front. I never quite got over that high school study teacher's voice. Really, there's no place I'd rather be, especially hearing Peter read off the list of people who collaborated to bring us together tonight, to know that I'm in a room full of people who have dedicated so much of your adult lives to ending the scourge of warfare and made sacrifices and have insights into how we can begin anew in the efforts to end the war in Afghanistan. I want to say something that's confessional, I think, and it's a bit of a parable, I suppose. I'll start by telling you that I graduated from Loyola University at the time as an undergraduate when you could really waltz away from the university with your overdue library fine, and that was it in terms of debt. But you had to make sure that you worked hard over the summers and had your part-time jobs during the school year. And so my sister, Loretta, said, oh, Kath, I've got a great job for you for the summer. And she encouraged me to go and get myself hired at Rose Packing Company. And my sister worked the night shift, and she didn't have to really work very hard, it turned out. But I got on for the day shift. And so my job every morning at 7 a.m. was to don a yellow rubber apron and yellow gloves and combat boots and a hairnet and goggles and a white smock that didn't stay white very long and go into the meatpacking factory floor, which was running with rivulets of blood and waste material. And there were three machines that were blaring loudly all throughout the day. And I was given a T-hook, a kind of a steel T-hook, and told to stand on top of a crate in front of a vat full of frozen pork loins, and my job was to start slinging. And so after the first hour of slinging pork loins, prying them loose from a vat full of frozen loins and putting them on the conveyor belt so that they could go through the pickle juice machine, which was squirting pickle juice in my eye as well. Well, after the first hour, I think I'd gone through every memorized prayer or poem I'd ever heard. And by the second hour, I'd pretty well gone through all the Broadway tunes I ever knew. By the third hour, I was hoping those Jesuits would have some mighty good courses waiting for me. And it was very exhausting work. And sometimes you'd get hauled off the pork loin line to put tiny chips behind little Canadian pork butts. And the conveyor belt seemed to me to go very, very fast at that point. And then sometimes I'd be sent over to the easiest job in the factory, which was my sister's normal work at night. And that just meant pressing down on a pedal that would squirt waste material collected off the factory floor into plastic tubing, and that's how they made hot dogs. So yes, I became a vegetarian at the end of the first summer. And I think I took that job, which gave me an 8 cents per hour income increase, and I actually went back a second summer. Now, the reason why I wanted to tell you this long story is that I don't know why, but in January of last year, I had a sort of epiphany. And I realized that had anyone ever come up to me in the previous years and said to me, "Kathy Kelly, you slaughtered animals," I would have said, "No, there are a lot of Kathy Kellys. You've got the wrong girl. I'm a city person. I never killed an animal in my life." Well, the truth is, yes, I was, for two summers, for the sake of 8 cents an hour, very much a part of the process. How could I get around it? Of slaughtering animals. And I'm not telling you this story because I want to talk about animal rights particularly, although I know that's a crucial subject. But the reason I tell this story is it took me 40 years to arrive at the point where I could realize that I was part of the slaughter of animals in my job at the Rose Packing Company. And I think that analogously here in the United States, we've been at war in Afghanistan for 10 years. And by and large, it's a war that's been forgotten before it has even ended. It's the war whose sorrow is so distant, so far, maybe with the exception of those who have loved ones who are in Afghanistan now. But by and large, we don't feel the sorrow of that war. And when we don't feel the sorrow of war, it's so very hard to repent. So hard to seek forgiveness, and yet so crucial if there's to be a moral underpinning for our society and for our lives. Yesterday at 5 a.m., I returned to the United States, and it's the first time I couldn't leave the airport. I just sat there for an hour thinking about what it would mean to re-enter into my own country. And I wanted during that time to remember the people, particularly in a place called Chatahee Kambar. And the Chatahee Kambar refugee camp is populated by about 7,000 people who had formerly been quite happy to live in the San Jin district of the Helmand province of Afghanistan. They were goat herders. They sold yogurt. They'd fatten up their goats, and sometimes they'd sell the livestock, and they weren't looking to leave. But at some point, somebody, possibly with a Taliban group, came into their area, and that person maybe was on the screen of somebody doing surveillance, maybe through drone aircraft, maybe there was some informer that had spotted this person as a, at any rate, it occasioned a United States aerial bombardment. One man showed me the pictures of two of his children, their bodies mutilated and lifeless. He'd lost his wife and his five children. His three brothers said, "We can't wait around to see if we'll be hit again." And so they fled. And they came to Kabul, And the only place where they could go is this wretched refugee camp. When I walked in, one of the men whom I'd met before, who was showing us around, you know, the gawkers from the United States in a sense, he flicked with his finger the blanket covering one of the tents. And there was an immediate cloud of dust, and the blanket ripped right away. And the situation with the tents is so decrepit. They can't build latrines or dig a well because the owner said, look, I want these people off this land. I don't want them to stay any longer. And the weather is getting so cold in Afghanistan now, they're soon going to have rains and snows, which will turn the dusty, unpaved ground to sludge and mud. It's a very degrading situation in which to try to raise your children. And the man who was talking to me looked at me in the eye and said, do you think that we like to live this way? Do you think that we want this for our children? And no, assuredly not. And if you look above the Chatahi Kambar refugee camp to the kind of hill just very visibly in the distance, you can see bunkers that are part of a huge sprawling base being built under construction for the United States military. Every single day, 7,000 Afghan and Pakistani men, often young boys, take their lives in their hands to drive truckloads of supplies to make sure that the United States military will be warm and fed and given water and beverage and have some of the approximations of the comforts of home. And who would begrudge that to any of them? And yet, what an incongruous reality that every single day, 850 Afghan children die. Every single day, 850 of their children die. And the United States is spending $1 million to keep each soldier in Afghanistan for 1 year. It costs now, according to November statistics, actually, I'm not sure of the price now, but in November of 2010, the cost to get 1 gallon of gasoline over to Afghanistan for the U.S. military usage, whether it was land vehicles or airborne vehicles, was $800 per gallon. Why? Because there are so many warlords controlling the roads in the distance when a plane load of fuel would arrive in Karachi and then be shipped by truck transport that the United States is paying the various warlords and often Taliban warlords to let the convoys pass through. What kind of sense does the futility of this war make? I met a young Italian nurse, and he said that every day $1 million is spent daily to keep the entire Italian contingent of the NATO ISAF forces in Afghanistan. He said, allora, can you imagine what I would do if I had $1 million, not unlike these youngsters in the films we just watched. He said, with $1 million, I could build 4 hospitals. But, of course, the money goes into the pockets of so many people who are profiting from this war, a war profiteering that seems to be utterly relentless, while those who are bearing the brunt of the war cannot easily find voices that get through to people in the United States, even though so many of them would like to see a non-military option. They aren't hearing about a partnership that might be coming from any groupings within the United States, and that's one of the gaps that we can start to fill. I'll tell another story that comes from my own personal life and hope that this can work as a window, as an opening. I was in Iraq throughout the Shock and Awe bombing, and it was shocking and it was awful. And when I came back to the United States, I knew that my only way to fit back in was actually to spend some time in a prison in resistance to the warfare that had so badly brutalized children and families all across Iraq. And I knew that military police were being trained at Fort Benning to go and serve in Iraq. And so I joined the School of the Americas effort to close down that school, but I was thinking a lot about the military police that were being sent to Iraq. But it wasn't my first season out with civil disobedience. So actually going through, after I was arrested, the ropes of the security and getting booked, to me, wasn't any more dramatic than going through O'Hare Airport and going through security there. I kind of, you know, done this before. I'm a good Catholic. I usually do what I'm told. And so I was told to go to Station J, and they unclipped the handcuffs. But as I mentioned to you, I was a former high school teacher, and sometimes that high school teacher just doesn't go away. And as it happened, there were, I think, 27 of us that were being processed that day, and something a bit different about it was that there were four soldiers in each of the checkpoints and a fifth person with a clipboard, and it seemed like maybe they were going through a training exercise. And the commands, the orders, were being shouted, and it was the most aggressive search I'd ever experienced. Hands inside of clothing and people being pretty rough, and I was the youngest one practically of those who'd been arrested. These were nuns and priests. And so as the orders were being barked at me, raise your arms higher, spread your legs further, the high school study teacher came back. And I looked at the young soldier who was screaming at me, and I asked, could you help me understand why you're screaming at me? Don't say anything! Keep your eyes glued on the soldier in front of you! Raise your arms higher, spread your legs further! And at one point, and again, you know, hands inside of clothing with this aggressive search, and I was told to raise my left leg higher, and I lost my balance, and all of a sudden another kind of balance came back. And I very quietly said, I'm sorry, but I can't cooperate with this any longer. Bam! I was down on the floor in seconds. My wrists were tied. My ankles were tied. My wrists and ankles were tied together. They call it hogtied. And somebody about the size of you, sir, was kneeling on me and referring to me with an expletive, and I couldn't breathe. And so I said, I'm sorry, but you're hurting me and I can't breathe. Nothing. This person didn't get up, and I thought, well, I'll pass out. I better try again. So I said again, excuse me, but this really hurts and I can't breathe. Guy wasn't getting up. So I actually have, because of congenital disease, tissue on my lungs, had four lung collapses. I tried one more time. Look, I've had four lung collapses in the past, and I can't breathe. That did it. The fellow got off of me, and I was okay. I was still hogtied, and they took me to the next station where they take your picture, right, and propped me up. But in order to take my picture, you know, they take the scrunchies out of your hair, so the hair is in front of my face. I look like the shaggy dog. And the young soldier who was carrying me under my right armpit very gently asked me, ma'am, in order to take your picture, I'll have to move the hair from in front of your face. Will that be all right? And I said, yeah, that's fine. So he moved my hair, and then he squeezed my shoulder. He said, I know those cuffs are real tight, ma'am. We're going to get them off of you as soon as we can. Now, isn't that how it so often happens? Just when you think the lights have gone out on human kindness and compassion, some reassertion happens. And I want to hang on to that because I believe we can say to the people of Afghanistan, we know those cuffs have been real tight. We're going to get them off of you as soon as we can. What are the cuffs? Well, President Obama, when he put General McChrystal in power, took a man whose brief, whose experience in Iraq had been in building up the Joint Special Operations Forces. Now, what do those Joint Special Operations Forces do? They train some of the strongest, most durable warriors in the United States military formation to engage in death squads, night raids, assassinations. And what happens if a night raid is occurring? Well, they have dogs and they have lights and they go to an unsuspecting place, kick in the door, hogtie the householders, load them handcuffed into pickup trucks and take them away for days or maybe weeks, and sometimes for interrogation and sometimes for torture. And this is if the group is lucky, because sometimes they may have been told this was a bomb-making squad. December 26th, this was the bad information that was given. They broke in, and it was like the My Lai Massacre. They took six youngsters out of their beds, shot them execution style in the head. The people were enraged in the village. They went to the intersections. They shouted, death to Americans, death to Americans, in their rage and their fury. I wish I could say that that's the exception. But there's been an underreporting of civilian casualties, according to 29 NGOs that signed on to a report called Nowhere to Turn. And these 29 NGOs begged the United States military, ISAF, NATO, stop the night raids. Stop arming Afghan police by going into villages and saying, well, you guys look pretty tough. You can be the local militia. This is a prescription for more civil war. They have said that there has to be an end to the drone bombardment that sometimes has the wrong person in the first place. But even if they have the right person, why should that, quote, right person, why should that person's children and wives and family members all be instantly killed as well? So when President Obama gave his December review and said that progress was being made, there was no mention of any kind of progress because you can't find any progress in a country where 850 children are dying every day, where the average life expectancy is 44 years of age, where one-fifth of the children will not live beyond their fifth birthday. I was in the tiny village of Bamyan and meeting with families who work hard. The youngsters, the boys get up at 2 o'clock in the morning for a six-hour donkey ride to go and collect fuel off the mountainside, a scrub brush and whatever twigs and branches they can find, and then the long donkey ride back home. And then at 6 o'clock in the morning, if it's not a day to go get fuel, they're up to go and get the water, again taking the donkey out. It's a very hard life, and the rest of the day they pull potatoes out of the ground, and they'd like to study. Their schools are corrupt, but three of them by now have learned English because they stay up and study at night, but there's no electricity. 2 hours of electricity in the Bamyan province. Hardworking people. I met the mother of one of these boys, and I kind of estimated, oh, she seems like she'd be about maybe in her 60s. She was 38 years old. It's a very hard and a harsh life amongst people who mean us no harm. And yet the United States has enacted cruel and abusive and lethal warfare in Afghanistan now, approaching longer than 10 years, longer than the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, in a war that most people in the United States aren't even aware is going on. How shall we feel the sorrow of this war? I went to the emergency hospital run by Italians. Some of you had maybe heard Gino Strada when he spoke here in Philadelphia some years back. And the Italians, it's a wonderful idea. They say the preventive medicine, the best preventive is to stop producing the weapons, to stop the wars. And they'll treat anybody. I was asking a lot of questions. They weren't asking any questions. They stitch up people no matter who comes to them. But when you see the children, I don't think you have to worry, well, are they going to tell us lies or are they going to tell us the truth? The truth is these children shouldn't be victims of warfare. And there was little Esmatullah. His eyes were beaming. He's 7 years old. And Anil, the physical therapist, patted him on the head and said, in spite of all the changes of dressings, he's been here a month and a half, and his arm was shattered and destroyed, and one of his legs was also badly injured because of a mine blast. He said he's a real Pashtun. He never cries. And then there was Saifullah, who had been one of those truck drivers, and his luck had held out for 3 years, driving a truck along roads where improvised explosive devices might be planted, and the U.S. vehicles at the front and the back of the convoy were the MRAPs with the armored mine-resistant equipment, but the people driving the actual goods didn't have any such thing, and they didn't have GPS systems, and so after the third year, this youngster's luck ran out, and he drove over an improvised explosive device, and the United States soldiers took his broken body and medevaced him and dropped him off at the Italian hospital in the Helmand province in Lashkargah, and he never heard from them again. No question of rehabilitation for his shattered body. No question of paying for any of the ongoing medical treatment he would need or some kind of vocational rehab. He was all used up. He didn't have bitterness. But I asked him, Saifullah, Can you imagine if the United States were to invade your village? He lives in Panjshir, where families typically have 15 children, and the family is desperately poor, and he had wanted to work to bring money into his family. I asked him, if the United States forces invaded his village and killed people, what would he do? And he said, oh, then I would fight. I would fight to the death. Well, it seems to me that many of the young fighters who either out of economic desperation or because of revenge join up with the Taliban ranks possibly have more in common with United States soldiers than soldiers on either side have with the warlords who are sending them forth into war. Because if you go into the gyms or the lunchrooms of any of the U.S. high schools where recruiters are trying to get youngsters to go into the war, many of them are not even going because of revenge. They're going because they'd like to get some extra money, or they'd like to get out of town, or their prospects aren't very good, and so they sign up. But is the United States militarily making progress against the Taliban? Two United States intelligence agencies have written up reports that said no, in spite of President Obama's December review claiming that fragile but reversible gains have been made. His own intelligence experts are saying, no, that's not true right now. And this may be why 63% of the U.S. public are saying that they're against this war, that the war is futile, that they don't want the war to continue. But it hasn't yet become a political issue. And I think that may be because we are not feeling the sorrow of warfare. Why is it so important to President Obama to continue this war? At the NATO conference that happened in Lisbon in November, mid-November of 2010, the kind of showcase deal that was cut was the revelation of the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline, the TAPI pipeline. And they have the Asia Development Bank agreeing now to fund the construction of this pipeline. And China would like to get its resources for energy, for fuel, for natural gas from that area. But if the United States controls the pipeline, then the United States has a leg up in U.S. relations, economic relations, maybe even Cold War relations with China. And this could have everything to do with why the United States wants to build bases all across Afghanistan, build the roadways to connect those bases, but make a better life for people in Afghanistan. It hasn't been evident so far in these long and horrid years of warfare. Harold was so good in saying that he would assist me with some maps. I haven't usually used PowerPoints in my life, but I realized it was so important for me to get in touch with some maps from the area. And so I think it's important to notice that in those 33 provinces in Afghanistan, 34, 33 of the 34 are reputed to have shadow governance that's controlled by the Taliban. And the provinces are divided up into districts. A district governor's salary for a month is $70. And his operating expenses for an office, mostly men, there are some women though, would be $15 for the month. Well, you can guess people are going to be out moonlighting trying to find some other ways to augment their jobs. And no doubt many of the people who get into the level of governance of a district are people who are also in tune with the smuggling and the opium operations that go on as well. But meanwhile, contrast those stats with how much the United States is spending to keep one soldier $1 million per year. Could we do the next map? Thank you. And that'll take us through a number of this is a map that was devised by a CIA analyst. And when I was in Pakistan in 2009, I mentioned this map. And amongst the more affluent, educated people in Pakistan, there was not one person that I met who wasn't very familiar with this map. And for those of you in the back, I hope you can see this. On the left-hand side is the real map. This is the way the borders look now. And you'll notice that Pakistan shares a border with Iran, you know, right underneath Afghanistan. We have that border between Iran and Pakistan. And it also shares a northern border with China. But the CIA analyst was imagining what might be best for U.S. national interests. Now, we've got a Muslim country, the only Muslim country to possess the nuclear bomb, and a country that shares its border with Pakistan. So this analyst imagined, well, what would happen if Afghanistan sort of extended its northern border so that it cut off Pakistan's border with China? And watch very closely as you hear news reports about Balochistan and the United States saying that the Pakistani government must respect the human rights of the Baloch people who are struggling. Well, I agree with that too. But is it possible that it would be considered advantageous by some for Balochistan to break away from Pakistan so that you'd cut off Pakistan's border with Iran? These are the kinds of geopolitical questions which many of the analysts from the United States are being paid enormous sums of money to ask and to design. We'll be told, meanwhile, that the purpose for the United States to be in Afghanistan or Pakistan is to dismantle and eradicate Al-Qaeda. Well, Barbara Boxer said in December of 2009, there maybe are about 8 dozen Al-Qaeda figures. Leon Panetta then went on to say in 2010 that the number might be about 57, and maybe there are 300 Taliban in the area of Pakistan. Why are we spending billions? Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes calculate that ultimately it will be trillions of dollars in order to eradicate a half dozen Taliban figures. It simply doesn't add up. We'll also be told, well, this is humanitarian because if you care about women's rights, you have to keep the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. Well, I should share with you the anger of some university students whom I met in Bamyan. These were engineering students, and a couple of them spoke English quite well. And we were sitting on the floor, and one of them asked me with kind of a white-hot anger, do Americans care more about noses than fingers? And honestly, I was out. I didn't know what he was talking about, and I looked at my companions to see if somebody else had a fix on this, and I ended up just writing a hurried note. And I was back at the Mary House Catholic Worker reading the New York Times, and I realized, oh. And some of you may have kept up on this story that a striker brigade in Washington State was comprised of some soldiers who had gone on at least a 3-month killing spree. And during that time, there were 5 accused soldiers led by a staff sergeant who apparently had gotten in the habit of not only killing innocent victims, executing people extrajudicially with no cause, with no prior charge, and then cutting off the fingers of their victims and storing them as jars to take home as war trophies. And the student had held up the cover from Time magazine, and most Americans, I think, know the ghastly story of the young woman whose face was mutilated by male relatives in her family. And that's a horrible reality. But I think we have to try to hear those young students who were asking the ghastly question, do Americans care more about noses than fingers? And in a much more gentle way, my young friend Faiz, part of the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, came up to me after we'd had a session with civil society leaders in Bamyan, and he said, Kathy, I have always been trained not to speak up in any way that might contradict my elders, and so I was afraid to say anything in the meeting, but I have this question. I said, yes, Faiz, what is your question? He said, in some ways, aren't the United States troops becoming like the Taliban? And these are the kinds of questions I think we need to hear. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said it so beautifully in the Riverside Church when he spoke about Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence. He said to us, we have to see ourselves as we are seen by our adversaries. And we have to see the humanity in our adversaries. And this would be the way forward. But in President Obama's December review, and I would predict again when they make the June 2011 review, and when in July they say, oh, well, you know, we really can't be serious about that withdrawal date because we have to be realistic and we have to stay till 2014, and then it may be 2017, and on and on and on with the killing continuing. I believe the problem is that we get disconnected. It's almost as though we hear disembodied concepts. We don't recognize the humanity of our brothers and sisters in Afghanistan, in Iraq. It's a bit of an irony in my own life. Wasn't too easy on my Irish mother, that the first time I was ever arrested was way back during the time when the draft was being reinstated under the Carter administration. And a number of us had gone to the United States Post Office in Chicago's downtown, a kind of cavernous place, and we decided that we would sing songs and hope that maybe some of the youngsters who were registering for the draft might at least know that there were some people who would recommend another option and try to support them if they refused to register for the draft. And so we went to sing some songs, and the one that seemed to work the best, really, was an Irish ballad, and I'd like to share that with you because for me it's my way of getting in touch with that sorrow of warfare. A lot of you heard this song, you maybe sang it as kids. Your teachers would have taught it to you. When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah. But that's not the original song. There's some song that predated that little jingle that we sang. Padre Colum wrote the lyrics to a song that was sung as Irish conscripts returned from the Seychelles. They've been forced into war by the British, and these Irish conscripts returning were maimed and wounded and limping, and some of them were eyeless, and some of them were armless. And so Padre Colum wrote these words. While on the road to sweet as I, haroo, while on the road to sweet as I, haroo, haroo, while on the road to sweet Athy, a doleful damsel I did espy, with a stick in her hand and a tear in her eye, of Johnny I hardly knew ya. Where are your legs that used to run, haroo, haroo? Where are your legs that used to run? Oh, oh, where are your legs that used to run before you went to carry a gun? I believe your dancing days are done. Oh, Johnny, I hardly knew ya. And the singer goes on to sing about the arms and the eyes that are missing. And it ends with a rebellion. The singer sings, they're rolling out the guns again, haroo, haroo. They're rolling out the guns again, haroo, haroo. They're rolling out the guns again, but they'll never take our daughters and sons again. No, they'll never take our daughters and sons again. Oh, Johnny, I'm swearing to ya. And I think of those youngsters maimed and mutilated, maimed and mutilated in a hospital in Kabul, Esmatullah, Saifullah, Asidullah. And I think about the young Afghan youth peace volunteers who are working so hard to try to put a non-violent, non-military option on the table. And I think for all of us, swear, swear that we won't support the warfare, that we'll be part of that community of people who could be the tipping, the beginning of the tipping of putting war behind us, not for our generations immediately, but for the next generations who right now are saddled with that horrible bill, saddled with that horrible debt to pay for this war. I think to myself of the 40 years that transpired when I, like a fog-ridden person, never realized that I'd been directly involved in the slaughter of animals, and I'm sorry now. And I want us to realize that we can say, put an end to slaughter. It's not who we are. It's not who we want to be. It's not what we want to pay for. There's no vocation more important for any one of us than to stop these wars. And in doing so, to rub shoulders with some of the finest people in the world, including our brothers and sisters in Afghanistan. Thank you.
We'll take questions just from the floor and sort of make it brief, and hopefully we can spend some time in dialogue with Kathy.
Kathy, many of us have been following you for 7 or 8 years, but I'd like to go back for a split second to last January at CIA Gates in Langley, Virginia. That was one fabulous action that you led, and you kept everyone really pumped up, and especially when we were around the corner to Cheney's house, too. I'd like to thank you for the panel, the you and Colonel Ann Wright and Phyllis Dennis and Raj Jura. One, actually, a resolution that was really put down on the Mideast and the occupation, all the occupation, and the future occupation in Austin at the IAW convention. We really appreciated that. But later on in July, I hope that you could explain, if you have time, a little bit about the UNAC Continuations Committee that we did up in Albany. And I'd also like to thank you for the spirit that affected us, that guided us, that drove us all through the planning for December 16th, in October and November, when 600 veterans, 600 people led by veterans, 131 of whom got arrested in the snow. The whole idea of creative nonviolence is infectious. It's just totally... Everything you ever preached came out, just flowed out of us in that action. But what I really want to know is, Hakim from Banyam, he was worried about having to leave the country because the local people may not have approved of what he had done with the teenagers on New Year's Day. How did that work out? And the people who were supposed to schedule the period to speak, I guess they were so overwhelmed because I got called 3 different times. I could never get it in on the stack. But they were still very interested in listening to the kids. They were so enthused. They were so, especially towards the end, they were so happy. Can you tell us a little bit about sitting there that day and listening to the kids?
Well, these boys are hard working, and I was pretty exhausted after hanging out with them for 3.5 weeks. They started their time by going over to donate blood at the emergency hospital, the Italian hospital that I'd mentioned, and sitting with some of the youngsters whose bodies have been broken and maimed. And after that, they went with us to the Chattahi Kambar refugee camp, and they told us later that they themselves could remember being toddlers and carried on their older brother's shoulders or their uncle's shoulders and living in the snow without any tents at all during one of the times when their families had had to flee. And they were aware of this Nowhere to Turn report signed by 29 NGOs, and so they systematically went with us to meet the representatives of many of these NGOs, and then we jointly created a People's December Review, an alternative to President Obama's review, and we held a press conference, and it was attended by all the local media, and it was one of the first times that the local media actually talked to each other, because they're afraid, too. They're all owned by various warlords, but they came together and they spoke. It was really quite brilliant. And then the other thing that they wanted very much to do was to hear from Afghans in diaspora. So first they interviewed Noam Chomsky for a half hour, and I think Noam Chomsky was actually very pleased to speak with them. And then they opened up the questions that Noam Chomsky had given to them. What do Afghans want? And there were people from all over the world who called in on December 19th. And then after that, they decided that they should try to give some kind of indication of popular sentiment, the 60% of the U.S. public, and in other NATO countries, it's also between 40 and 60% of the populations that want this war to end. So they thought, let people call in to us their wishes for peace, and we called it the Dear Afghanistan campaign. And so for another 24 hours, and this was the one where you had called in, the lines were pretty full, and people were Twittering and emailing and Facebooking and all. I mean, I'm finally getting dragged into the 21st century by these rural peasants in Bamyan. But it was really a very wonderful day of discussion. And it rocks the boat a little bit. Some of the statements that these youth have put out are very strong statements. So, sure, people in Bamyan are I think, very proud of these youngsters, but they're also nervous. You know, it's not normal for young people to be hosting Westerners. That in itself is a movement into another world, and that doesn't even begin to talk about us taking them to Skatistan. It's a skateboard place in Kabul, and actually, maybe their moms won't see that video. But it was really quite, it was a marker event for me to get to know these youngsters. And I really encourage you, if you have any extra time, to become familiar with the Nowhere to Turn report, which was signed on to by 29 NGOs and directly challenges NATO and ISAF. And these are people who have been working on the ground, speak the language, and have been there for years. And secondly, the People's December Review, which was created by the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. And then they have videos. It's interesting. It's a parallel to the videos that Peter showed. And you can see these videos on Journey to Smile. And they're really very amazing videos of these youngsters in their everyday life with subscripts, and they speak in Dari. And the way that I first encountered these youngsters was during a fast last year. There's a new one coming up for the Witness Against Torture. And as part of the fast, we decided to have a Skype phone call, because the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers, very unusually for youngsters in their setting, were accompanying us in the Witness Against Torture fasting for 3 days. This fast lasted for 12 days. So we got in touch by Skype, as it happened, on January 15th. And Carmen Trotta from New York poked me, and he said during this Skype phone call, "Hey, it's Martin Luther King's birthday. Do you think maybe I could mention that to these kids?" And I said, "Sure, it's a free country. Go ahead." And Carmen told the youngsters that this was the birthday of a very important leader for peace in the United States, whose name was Dr. Martin Luther King. And we didn't have any video capacity, but we could hear a kind of commotion at the other end. Well, it was the kids jostling to see who would be the first to come up to the cell phone and deliver their memorized quote from the speeches of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. Ask me to give you a memorized quote from Bacha Khan, their peace leader. I'm sorry, I'm still out. I should memorize something. But it's pretty remarkable, isn't it? And I could give you many more stories of exactly that kind of attitude. Even people who'd survived drone bombing. You know, people over there call it Tayara Computer. And they'll say, Nevada. They know the Creech Air Force Base is in Nevada. People in the United States don't necessarily know that, but people there do. But I actually heard genuine concern saying, you know, it's a real problem to us, the hatred that is caused by these drone attacks. And in another case, I said to a man, this is in Pakistan, but he was a survivor of a drone attack in Kaisur. And I said, "Can you ever imagine that if some people from the United States came to your village in North Waziristan, that people in your village would sit down and have a conversation with the Americans?" And he looked at me like I was off my rocker. He said, "Madame Kathy, who would be so crazy as to not to want the peace? Of course we would sit with your people. Just we ask you, please, to leave your weapons outside."
Okay, here we go. Yeah, thank you for everything. You're very inspiring. My question has to do with the interface between development and militarism. And, you know, there have been increased attacks on the development agencies, I've read. And at one point, I was researching how aid was delivered, and I discovered that the provincial reconstruction councils had the money, and they were giving it to the CDCs, community development agencies, that were administered by CARE, and that money was being given to women and, you know, for projects, various projects, but that what was happening was that it was undermining the leadership of the tribal council in those villages. And I just, it seemed to make sense to me then that the development agencies would be under assault because there was this direct connection between funds coming in through the U.S. military and the provincial reconstruction councils going directly to the development agencies administering this aid. And it doesn't seem hard for me to see the connection where you're undermining the legitimate tribal authorities and getting the community people to support Karzai or, you know, the government. And I just wanted to know, is there any, what did you see there in terms of development and militarism?
Well, there's a quite a lot of analysis about what are called the Beltway Bandits. At its worst, development aid has been earmarked for Afghanistan, but 80% of the aid has come back to the pockets of consulting corporations ringing Washington, D.C. And there's substantial analysis on that now. And this is what I mean when I talk about war profiteering. People who have highly paid salaries or who start projects, but as I said, 80% of the payment will go back to their own pockets. And as you've mentioned, with the provincial reconstruction teams, the PRTs, they may go out and do a needed project, for instance, to help build an irrigation system that hadn't existed before, or to install latrines. But the problem is that if the U.S. military seems to be coordinating and conducting these projects, if you have armed and uniformed U.S. soldiers out on the ground, then this jeopardizes the humanitarian work of others who are unarmed and don't want to be armed and ununiformed and don't want to be uniformed. And so many of the humanitarian groups in Afghanistan are asking the United States military not to fund through the military and through their presence humanitarian projects. But, of course, the United States wants to be able to say to people in the United States, look, here's a nice photo op. See the school we built. See the soccer field we built. Well, when we were in Iraq, we used to talk about drive-by schools because it's not that much technology, actually, that has to be installed to paint a building with a fresh coat of paint and hopefully put desks and chairs inside a room and maybe put in some window panes. It makes for a good press conference, but it doesn't necessarily create the culture of education that's so needed. And even Greg Mortensen has said that if you were to take 143 U.S. troops and march them onto a plane and send them all home, the money you'd save, 143 times 1 million being 104, would be enough to pay for higher education for the entire country. It's $40 a month for a youngster in Afghanistan to go to the university. But quite honestly, even if one of you gave me $500 and said, here, pay for one of those Afghan youth peace volunteers to go to the university, that would upset the balance, wouldn't it, if I, as an American, were choosing who's going to go to the university. It's not our choice. The question is not, what do we want for Afghanistan? The question is, what do Afghan people want for their country? Yes, pay reparations. The Soviets should pay reparations. The United States should pay reparations. Pakistan should pay reparations. All of these countries who waged proxy wars or furthered their Cold Wars or went in and invaded and occupied another land, those resources don't belong to us. It's not our pipeline to control. They're not our resources. And so I think we should be paying generous reparations to Iraq, to Afghanistan, to any country where we've trampled the human rights of people living there by bringing our warfare into their land and our hideous weaponry and all the pollution that comes with them. Yes, to paying reparations. But I myself am not impressed by the idea that out of our charity, the United States is developing the land for people who couldn't have taken care of their land themselves. Prior to these invasions and occupations, the 85% of the agriculture, the 85% of Afghanistan's population who are involved in rural agriculture had flocks that crisscrossed the country. The mountainsides were filled with orchards. They had mulberry and pistachio and walnut trees, and they had adequate irrigation systems. This has been ruined. It will cost $33 billion, according to the esteemed researcher Alfred McCoy, to replenish the flocks, to build the irrigation systems, and to reseed the orchards. $33 billion, that's one supplemental spending bill that the United States Congress passed to continue just another 6 month segment of our warfare. Is this the way we want to be characterized, as a menacing, dangerous, ruthless group of people? While 850 mothers every day carry the bundles of their dead children to the graveyards. Have we no heart? Have we no mercy? Have we no conscience? Thank you.
How are those 850 children dying per day?
They're dying from gastrointestinal diseases, from hunger and malnutrition, sometimes from respiratory infections, sometimes because of explosions. I talked about the ones who survived, but sometimes these children are on the mountainsides and they think, oh, look, I've got a landmine, and if I can open it up and extract the brass, then I'll make enough money to feed my family for a year, and then it explodes. Sometimes they've been mistaken as insurgents were in there on the mountainsides, and they've been killed. There were statistics that said 2012 civilians were killed in just the past year of the warfare, and among those, there certainly were many who are children.
And why are they dying of intestinal disease?
Well, the water is bad. They aren't getting potable water, and sometimes people are taking water from the same water sources where the animals are also using the water, and this can be one reason why they get gastrointestinal diseases. Also, it's not directly related to gastrointestinal disease, but the fecal matter in the air in Kabul is the highest in the world. And the smog was just awful. 3,000 people die every year just from breathing the air in Kabul.
Yeah, I have a question and also a request of everyone in this room. I'll do the request first. People had mentioned the Albany conference, and one of the resolutions that came out of that conference was for a major anti-war demonstration on April 9th in New York. So if you belong to an organization who has not endorsed that effort yet, plan to do that. The Philly Against War will be organizing transportation for that, and we really urge people, you know, to not just see this as, oh, another demonstration, but to see this as a key demonstration because of all the things that Kathy has said. And also, listening to the parallels that you talked about with the children and the young people in Afghanistan, and then thinking this week in Philadelphia, the superintendent of schools announced a proposal for a 30% cut in education in Philadelphia. You know, watching this film of the young people who made the film, you know, you think, well, what could $1 trillion do? And the options of those children in those schools, if 30% of the budget is cut in already underfunded schools, their option is to become the soldiers for the continuation of the war. But my question, it really relates to Pakistan, and it's very interesting to see the planned expansion of U.S. hegemony in that area. And I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit more on that in relationship to what seems to be signs of a resistance within Pakistan to continuing to cooperate with the U.S. war effort.
Thank you, Betsy. I'm all for the UNAC on April 9th. Thank you for reminding us of that date. And it's a sturdy coalition that survived a real challenge about whether or not to support resolutions about ending United States support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine and the siege of Gaza. And the group hung tight, so it's an estimable group. Harold, would you mind putting up another map for us, if you just go on to the next one. In Pakistan, there's an area called North Waziristan and South Waziristan, and the drone attacks on those two areas have just been steady and merciless. And the Pakistani government has said, you know, with a fifth of their country underwater over the flooding season, you know, please stop killing our people at this time when we're, you know, trying to overcome the worst catastrophe that's ever occurred in our history. But that there's been no let-up. The United States has said that they are going to go after the Taliban, who might be in North and South Waziristan, and the drone bombardment has been daily. One of the things you can notice in this map, or you might call it Pipelineistan, is the pipeline coming, this TAPI, from Turkmenistan going through Afghanistan, and it would then go through Pakistan and on to Delhi, to India. Now, there's a second pipeline called the Peace Pipeline. In this map, it's called the IPI. And that pipeline would go from Iran and cross into Pakistan and then to India. And the United States, of course, favors the TAPI, which UNICAL had started working on way back in the 1990s. And the United States, under the Bush administration, gave $11 billion to Pakistan. $8 billion of it went directly to the military. And people in Pakistan did not see money going into improving their lives, but rather into the coffers of the military. The military in Pakistan owns the pharmaceutical industry, the textile industry, the sugar industry, and large, large swaths of arable land. And so it's very difficult for any grouping other than the military or apart from the military to exercise any kind of governance inside of Pakistan. The military has a huge control, and the United States has been working in sync with the Pakistani generals and also with the ISI. And, of course, it's said that the ISI, which is their secret service, their very feared secret service, have coordinated their actions with the Taliban. So, you know, we think, well, all right, these drones are attacking Taliban figures in North and South Waziristan, and yet the United States continues a very strong, well-funded, to the tune of billions of dollars, relationship with the very grouping that many say is responsible for maintenance of the Taliban. So I think we have to ask ourselves, does the United States want to, in military terms, achieve a victory and an end to this war, or is the United States under General Petraeus interested in perpetual warfare? Why would anybody be interested in perpetual warfare? Well, that's a dumb question if you're working for General Electric, Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed, Martin Marietta. All of the major defense companies are making a huge profit. The Lady Gaga of the industry is the drone. And the generals make money too. So if you keep the war going, what's the problem? In the view of people who seem to have an abiding lock, like a vice grip, and I think we can speak about the military, industrial, media, congressional complex. They've got this vice lock on education in our country, and it's very hard for the average ordinary person to get the picture. Plus, people are enormously distracted by soccer, by sports, by entertainment. And so you have a population being wooed, being courted into acting like big children. We have to say we do not want to be big children. We have little children to take care of. And we'll take on our adult roles, our adult responsibilities, and tell the people in elected office that we do understand what's happening, that we have read, we have studied, and raise our voices and insist that a non-military option be on the table in Afghanistan, a non-military option. I want to tell you about Dr. Ramadan Bashar Dost. It's one of the great excitements of my life to have met this man. If you go to his office in Kabul, you ride along a dusty, unpaved, bumpy road, and you get to a very thin gate, and behind it, in an unpaved, sandy lot, is a tent. And Dr. Ramadan Bashar Dost, who came in third in the presidential election, who's the former minister of planning that resigned because of the corruption, who's an elected member of parliament but resigned because of corruption, is sitting at a purple plastic table, and you're invited to sit on purple plastic chairs under the sunlight in this vacant lot at his office, which is a tent. And his car is a kind of a jalopy. The Brits have something called the Mr. Bean car, and that's what his car, I guess, looks like. And he's painted it the colors of the Afghan flag. And you might think, well, this guy sounds like kind of a Lulu. But he's, I believe, one of the most together, thoughtful people offering a non-military option. In fact, he's the only person in the political horizon in Afghanistan today suggesting a non-military option. Now, I'm not sure about this option, but I know that my job is to try now to talk to people at the Center for Constitutional Rights, to continue dialogue with Noam Chomsky, with the bigs, to try to get to the Nobel laureates, to try to get the Blue Ribbon Panel assembled, that we, the people, can reach out to try to come up with the carrots, put all those carrots on the table, and try to see if there isn't a way to go forward. We've heard from people in Afghanistan, they want an end to the war. And this fellow Bashar Dost says that he believes the key is to be able to identify the criminal warlords. Well, immediately I'm thinking George Bush. But his idea is to get the Security Council in the United Nations to take over governance of Afghanistan for at least a year, during which time tribunals would be set up and the warlords would be brought to trial. These would be the drug lords. These would be people in governance today, Fahim, Khalili, General Dostum, people that Karzai has coped with as competing warlords by bringing them into the governance. And their hands are stained with blood, and people are afraid of them, and they've committed tremendous corruption. And when President Obama, following what was by many, many accounts a fraudulent election, called and congratulated Hamid Karzai, people felt like the nail was being put into their coffin. So his idea is to bring the criminals to trial, to accountability. But it was interesting. He doesn't want to see any of them killed or executed. He doesn't even want to see them go to prison. He just says, let there be accountability, public acknowledgement, and let the money that was stolen be returned. And again, I'm thinking, yeah, bring the United States into that accountability as well. He also believes that there could eventually be a regional unity as a way to solve the vulnerability to invasion, which many in Afghanistan rightfully feel. What if there were the prompting to form regional unity? Well, that's not the way the United States has wanted to deal with these situations where there are very precious resources that the United States would like to get at cut-rate prices or control. It's been much better in the U.S. view to balkanize, to separate, to break off, to play one party against another. But this fellow Bashar Dost, deliberately symbolizing the exact opposite of the warlords. He doesn't go around with a convoy of bodyguards and armored cars. He goes around in this jalopy with not a single armed bodyguard and has this tent that everybody in Kabul knows. If you ask anybody, a driver, a kid selling gum in the marketplace, who is Bashar Dost? Oh, yes, they smile. Their guard gets let down, really. He's much beloved as a symbol of somebody who's gone up against the corruption. Would the New York Times ever tell you about Ramadan Bashar Dost once in an article that made him look like a quack?
Have you spoken to Christoph?
Nicholas Christoph? Does he know Bashar Dost?
No, but I'm wondering whether you have talked to him and...
Well, believe me, if the New York Times won't tell you about Ramadan Bashar Dost, I'll never talk to Kathy Kelly, I guarantee you that. But we should certainly write letters to the editor and try to prompt Alyssa Rubin and the other New York Times correspondents and NPR and a whole lot of them to stop always giving the coverage to the generals and the warlords and take a look at some of the people who are trying to put a non-military, a non-killing option on the table. And these Afghan youth peace volunteers want desperately to do just that.
I want to make a comment, an observation, and then ask you a question. You have spelled out so clearly the way in which money is fueling these wars and the militarism of this country. I'm wondering how many of us here have pleaded with Congress to bring the war dollars home and put them to use in this country with the building up of our civil society, improving our infrastructure, educating our children, dealing with health care. It's money that's being squandered, and we all know that. Every one in this room knows that. If we're going to bring the money home, the war dollars home, there's a movement in this country that says we should refuse to pay those war taxes and to take the money that is refused and redirect it into our civil society and into all the programs that we know are so important, or to funnel it in some creative way into Afghanistan, into Iraq, with NGOs, but in some way to redirect those war dollars into peace work. I have much experience with war tax refusal, 50 years of it. And I also want to ask whether Kathy Kelly has thought about this and what she thinks might be another way for us to move forward in a more radical, that is a more fundamental way to deal with the war hysteria, the war psychosis, the war addiction that has afflicted our country for so long. I know that Kathy has thought about war tax refusal, and I'd like to know what her response is, whether there's any opportunity, any willingness in the peace movement and wider to think about redirecting our war dollars in a creative and civilly disobedient way to get the attention of the media, get the attention of this country. That's my query. That's my question for Kathy.
Thank you. I sometimes say that the IRS is my spiritual director. I haven't paid taxes since 1980. I've resisted all forms of federal income tax since 1980. And one of the things I learned was, in my own life, I mean, this is just a personal choice, I never want to let inconvenience get in the way of living in accord with my deepest values. And I haven't in my life paid a high price even of inconvenience in being a war tax refuser. Most of the choices that were necessary are ones that were much better for me in terms of quality of life. I mean, never make a virtue of a necessity. I don't want to drive a car. I'd kill somebody probably. I'm sorry, clumsy. And I don't like how many cars there are on the road. It pollutes, and Chicago's flat as a pancake, and bicycling is good for us, and walking is fine. So I take a lot of car rides, I know, but basically I want to try to eschew car culture. I was in a high school, and I saw in Canada a parking lot that was just about empty, and there were racks and racks of bicycles, and the youngsters are bicycling to school, and I just about danced into the kids' classroom. I was so happy to see that. I don't want to own a house. I'd much rather, you know, be living in community and share responsibility for living. And I think, you know, we wouldn't have a problem with homelessness in this country if everybody who does own a big old house would, you know, share that space. We have too much space for each individual, and people think, you know, they have to give their kids even more space and more bathrooms. And I just came from a place where, you know, six kids all crowded into one room, and, you know, we were warmer because we slept with a bunch of people, sleep in a heap. And it's great that this building has gone green as well. I think that the idea that we have to have our own personal savings accounts is an overblown idea. I was taught by nuns, and one wonderful thing they taught us was that they never had the slightest interest in accumulating personal wealth. And those women gave us, I mean, people say, where's church leadership in the Catholic Church? I think of the nuns. That was a wonderful lesson that we could have availed ourselves of as an immigrant generation growing up. But instead, I think we've had this idea that you're better off if you become a rabid money maker, and then you can give your children more money. I don't know that we are raising generations of happier children. Quite honestly, I was with these youngsters they said to us, "What is Christmas?" You know, they never have seen television. They're some of the finest youngsters with some of the best values that you could ever imagine. And I'm pretty critical right now of how we've gotten into patterns of raising children that involve so much sports and entertainment. So the families are caught up. I mean, I could never do my sister's lives. They just had to run to take the kids to the soccer game and take the kids to Little League and take the kids to this and that, and they're always in the car, and they had to have SUVs. And it's not the only game in town. So I'm glad that in order to resist federal income tax, I couldn't have belongings. And I'm also glad that I never could have a job that I would be so tied to that I couldn't leave it if the IRS decided to garnish my wages. I love teaching. The job that I left when the IRS garnished the wages was one of the best jobs I'd ever had. But there's no job in this world that would be more important than my job of giving witness to peacemaking such that I won't pay for weapons. If the mafia came to my door and said, "We want to take a third of your wages to pay for mafia activity," I know I'd say, "Oh, sorry, do what you're going to do, but you're not going to be able to take my wages for that." Well, I'm certainly not going to give it to the United States military. I won't pay for nuclear war, chemical warfare, FBI, Abu Ghraib, CIA. I won't pay for any of the sordid, rotten, futile expenditure of U.S. wealth and productivity on maiming and killing other people's children. I've been in war zones now repeatedly. In Gaza during Operation Cast Lead, as the United States was ferrying more and more weapons throughout the summer in Lebanon and the Hezbollah-Israel war, where 4 million cluster bombs were dropped and people in the Edina, Minnesota weapon-making factory, Alliant Tech, had helped bust those weapons over. In Iraq, all through the shock and awe bombing, explosives causing little children to grind their teeth morning, noon, and night. I will never pay for war. A Pakistani journalist wrote recently that hunger and anger are like two live wires. And when they connect, there's an incandescent flash that you can't control. And in Pakistan, hunger and anger are connecting. And in Afghanistan, hunger and anger are connecting. Here in the United States, let us feel our anger, but let it be governed by our hunger for peace, our hunger for the golden rule, our hunger to live as brothers and sisters with other people. We are all part of one another. Hunger for it. Kathy, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
I just think your latest presentation was particularly meaningful, and thank you for that and all your wonderful work.
I'm with Peace Action Philadelphia, and I would like to know of a strategy that you think would really be significant and that we could exercise that would really make a difference in stopping.
Well, I'm very keen on getting behind Ramadan Bashar Dost and his vision of a non-military solution. It's kind of a work in progress, but to make him known. I'm very keen on the Afghan Youth Peace Volunteers. Please go to their website, Journey to Smile, and watch those videos. See these kids in action. Please read the Nowhere to Turn report that was signed by 29 NGOs, extremely directly critical of the ISAF-NATO presence, and also the December review, an alternative people's review. And then I think that the circle that we most need to grow is the circle of people willing to do what so many of you have done all throughout your adult lives. It's not particularly glamorous, I know, but the circle of people who will do the nuts and bolts work of building our peace community. Some of you were very, very active in the Pledge of Resistance days when we stopped intervention in Central America. Don't you remember going to a meeting once a week, either locally or the next week, the regional gathering or the citywide gathering? And don't you remember that the demonstrations were once a month, that your summer vacations or your vacations from your job were spent going to Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, that learning Spanish became an indispensable part of peace work? We've now been at war in Afghanistan for 10 years. People don't even know what the languages are that are spoken in Afghanistan. And we don't go so regularly, so methodically to our peace movement gatherings. And I think that our attention has been pulled many times in directions that have a lot to do with clickativism, staying home in front of the computer. We've got to be on the phones, organizing the communities, face-to-face gatherings, supporting this wonderful community here of AFSC. I've watched Peter work ever since he was in his 20s when he was on the streets of Chicago, working hard on behalf of peace and justice. And I can spot so many of you in this audience, and some of those, Shane, who left with some of his friends. I know I'm talking to the choir, but right now the choir, in a sense, I think we might need a little tune-up. And also, you know, to remind ourselves that this is where we find our joy and our passion, that this is what we can bequeath to next generation. So it's not more glamorous. There's no, as they say, magic bullet, I suppose. I do support the idea of delegations going over to Afghanistan and Pakistan and continuing to keep relationships going with people in Iraq, and particularly with refugees who are in need of resettlement from Iraq. And that's a tall order. All of that engages us, I know, in a great deal of work. But we don't know exactly what went into the mix of the abolitionists who found themselves at an unexpected tipping point. And then slavery, in terms of the buying and selling of human beings, was not practiced any longer. Now, we've seen tipping points in our collective generation. When I was a kid, if somebody announced that they were gay, well, A, it would never have happened, and B, that person would have endured a lifetime of slander, it would seem. But now, even George Will, wearing his little bow tie, declared on Meet the Press, or one of those talk shows, that for youngsters today, being gay is no more exceptional than being left-handed. Now, that may be minimizing the experiences of youngsters in a culture that still has a great deal of vituperative capacity. But what I'm saying is that we have seen significant changes, significant progress in our lifetimes. 95% of our lives are spent resolving problems and disputes with no resort to violence. We don't punch one another. We don't deck the bus driver if the guy passes us up and splashes us with water. But the 5% of our lives that's resting in formation of foreign policy is predicated on threat and force, and often brutal or tortuous or lethal threat and force. It doesn't have to be that way. It's not rational. But here we're facing a situation where the U.S. public is saying, don't raise taxes. Well, that's generally okay with me, but we're also being told, take U.S. wealth and productivity and pour it, just pour it into the coffers of the defense establishment, pay for these wars that are going to cost trillions of dollars, and what's left for housing, education, health care, infrastructure. I mean, it's totally irrational for the U.S. public to think that there's going to be anything left to preserve quality of life here in the United States if we're pouring our wealth and our productivity into the defense establishment. Does President Obama know this? I believe that he does. Is he willing to act on it? I think he's in the thrall of this complex, this military-industrial media congressional complex, that we can rebel nonviolently, creatively. We can rebel. And there's not going to be a death squad at our door. We're not going to face a Rio Simple type massacre. We're not yet going to be hit by drones. We're not going to find that our family members can be hauled away and tortured. We have the rights. We have an extensive set of rights and capacities, but we have to exercise them. You don't get freedom. You have to take it. And we have to exercise that right to free speech. Congress shall make no law to abridge the right of people to assemble peaceably for redress of grievance. Have we a grievance? Yes, we've got a deep and an abiding grievance. Take that grievance. On April 9th to New York, on April 8th to Washington, D.C. Come join us in D.C. for the fast from January 11th to the 22nd. There are groups acting all over this country. The Brandywine Peace Community is one of the strongest. You've got Catholic worker houses like House of Grace all across the country. There are so many opportunities to be knit into the nonviolent struggle to refuse, to repudiate, to reject the militarized society that becomes more and more fascist and more dangerous for future generations. And so I think collectively we can rise to the occasion. Barbara Deming, a beloved Quaker, had a wonderful poem, Locked in Winter, Summer Lies. Gather your bones together, rise. So let's remember that we can be part of the rising. We're only 6% of the world's population. The other 94% is hungering for us to rise up and speak clearly and truthfully about power and to power, and not to be dominated by little-minded, evil, and ruthless groups whose designs for the future are rotten and menacing.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Burnside. I became a Quaker 7 years ago because I walked into a Quaker house in San Francisco with two questions. The second was, what were Quakers doing to tax resist the Second Gulf War? She mentions being enthralled to a small group. We've all lived through the revolution in Eastern Europe. We're all getting up and leaving now, but I have a question for you. Would you give up your possessions? My last job, I wrote that I had no, I wrote none where it said dependence. I wrote will not sign where it said signature. I told everybody I was a tax war resistor. My job only lasted 6 months. You have children. You have houses. Early Quakers went to jail for decades because they wouldn't pay a tithe. My point to you is pretty basic. At some point, a community has to act, but before a community has to act, there has to be little seeds that the community can look at and say, oh, I can behave like that person. She's a seed, but she's spoken essentially three messages here. And I don't know that we really heard one-third of her message, which is she lives a life that does not have possessions. She lives a life in which she lost a job. She lives a life in which she does not give children an inheritance. She has a sacrifice. There is no reason for anybody else to pay attention to us if we don't sacrifice people. I was in Carbondale holding a sign at a peace rally. Walking up the streets of the peace rally the next week, I asked a young college student if he wanted to come stand with me. He said, no, but if you march on City Hall, I'll go with you. There are a lot of people that have courage. Most of them get hired by the U.S. government to go kill people in Iraq. Courage is an easily corruptible virtue. Many of the virtues are actually easily corruptible. You're good people. Who's to say you're not? Certainly not me. But we haven't changed the world. There's a general named Alexander Haig who said during the Vietnam War that you could protest in the streets all you want as long as you paid your taxes. Because it all runs on money. There was an article in Newsweek 7 years ago that said GM hadn't paid taxes in 10 years because it had accountants. It had lobbyists, and it had, if this division made a profit, that division had a loss. Very sophisticated group of people. Community does matter in the end. You have to sleep somewhere other than the streets if you don't own your own house. But if no one takes a step in sacrifices, no one's going to follow. And if we won't do it, it is absurd to think that a congressman's going to do it for us, much less a president.
May I say my thanks to all of you and all good wishes for your organizing and work and peacemaking in a community that I think really has planted many, many seeds. And it's certainly true that there's always further down the road that we can go. Evan Hennessy, I'm not sure if I would have liked him very much if I knew him, but I like much of what he has left us, and particularly his quote in which he calls for people to blend courage, wisdom, and love. Not the love of romance without the elements of courage and wisdom, not the courage of a soldier without the elements of wisdom and love, not the wisdom of academics without the elements of love and courage. So to seek for that blending of courage, wisdom, and love, and know that our opportunity to speak truthfully and clearly is one that could make a difference, could move us toward that tipping point. There's no greater vocation. Thank you.